Welcome back, Soil Nation. Trent Stout, Stout Seed, at Seed Junkie on Twitter, at Stout Seed on Twitter, also at Stout Seed on Facebook. If you like anything you hear today, you have more comments, you want to elaborate, feel free to reach out to me. I know we've been fielding questions all week from you guys, giving us feedback on our tweets, also on some Facebook posts. And so we always encourage that. We appreciate it. We love to carry on the conversation. Sometimes we don't get to the depth that we would like to in some of these episodes. So it's always good to have those individual conversations. So as you know, we spent last week in Wichita, Kansas for the No-Till on the Plains convention. It was one of the most top-notch conventions and lineups that we've seen kind of put together on the national stage that we've ever been to. And there was a lot of things that were really enlightening. There was a lot of things that were really good, that were kind of mind-blowing at the same time. So I wanted to take some time before I did this episode just to kind of digest and sit back and reflect and have some conversations to maybe better understand some of these new concepts, not necessarily new concepts on, but just when you're starting to take things and connect the dots, it can be challenging at times. And so I know I listened before I recorded this to Mitchell and Michael Vitito and Michael Cavan, who rode down to the conference together. I listened to their episode and what they had to say. And so I'm going to try not to be too redundant, but I think some of the key takeaways from the conference probably will be mentioned by both of us. And then at the end of the episode, I want to talk a little bit about the regenerative standard, we've been pushing for the past few years for a label for regenerative agriculture to try to capture premiums, since we know that the way that we treat our soils affects the food that we produce, as far as from a nutrient density and also from a lot of environmental reasons to why we feel those farming practices should be rewarded. And we had mentioned last season about General Mills and kind of how they were approaching and paying attention to the regen ag movement. And so I want to just touch on some of the things that we learned from them at the conference. So first thing is just kind of to go through some takeaways. I tried to keep a good group text going with some people where I just kind of gave key notes. I know if you want to go look me up on Twitter at Seed Junkie, also at Stout Seed. I did do some Twitter posts with the hashtag NTOP19. And so you could see the whole breadth of some of the things that we found to be interesting. So we'll just start with some takeaways that I had. The first thing I think from the kind of common themes that we heard is that the key to everything that we're trying to do from a no-till and from an environmental standpoint, from a water quality standpoint, from a nutrient density standpoint, and building our soils from a cover crop standpoint, is that there is a lot of value in roots. I think sometimes we get caught up in looking at just what we can observe above the ground, but what I think was one of the most alarming or one of the most challenging comments was that really it's all about what happens below the ground and not necessarily as much as what happens above the ground. And there are some keys to things in getting big biomass above the ground that are very beneficial. So I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is that as far as building soil organic matter and building resiliency in our soils, the keys seem to be the roots. So Jay Fuhrer talked a little bit about less than 15% of carbon produced above ground actually gets into the soil. 85% of that carbon in the above ground biomass actually dissipates into the atmosphere. So when you're going about soil organic matter and building, you know, topsoil, removal of above ground biomass doesn't necessarily seem to be as harmful as maybe what we once thought it was. And I think that provides unique opportunities for people who have livestock to be able to not worry so much about the forage or even corn stalks or that residue removal, and it actually provides opportunity for them to maybe draw some profits off that acre that aren't as devastating or aren't as harmful as maybe one would originally think, as long as we're leaving, you know, those roots in the system. We're not actually harvesting the roots or harvesting any of the below ground residue. Most of that carbon from that plant is going to go to building soil organic matter. And so I thought that was a really key point. Again, that came from Jay Fuhrer. There's another note that I had here that kind of ties into that as well. And so that was coming out of Chris Nichols. Chris Nichols talked about how the biology in the soil, the below ground biology in the soil, has a 21-day lifespan. And if you do not have a living plant or you do not have living roots in your soil, within 21 days of when that plant stops photosynthesizing, your biology will actually start cannibalizing itself and lead to a reduction in soil organic matter. So if you're going about building, you know, or regenerating your soils, and soil organic matter seems to be the gold standard for which a lot of us pay most attention to, not saying that's correct, but just saying that it seems like most people want to talk about soil organic matter, you need to have a living plant. You need to have photosynthesis going on, feeding the biology in your soil. You need to be harvesting sunlight 365 days out of the year, if possible. And that will protect the biology and help you longer in, you, it'll help you faster in the long run. And I had a slide that I posted on Twitter that got, you know, a little bit of buzz. And that was the idea that kind of ties into all of this as well, that we can actually build soil organic matter 5 times faster with roots, the carbon from the roots, than we can with biomass above ground. And so that, you know, again, all these things kind of tie together. Maybe I'm sounding a little redundant, but the key is roots. The key is photosynthesis and roots and the carbon that we can produce from that. So there are very, very much, there is very much value in above ground biomass from a, you know, erosion standpoint. There's, you know, the roots are important in that as well. But from, you know, if you're rolling big biomass covers, you know, from just having residue to keep moisture in our soil so that we're not evaporating moisture into the atmosphere, and to also prohibit sunlight from getting to the soil so that we can, you know, potentially suppress weeds. There is a lot of value in that. But as far as regeneration, roots are the key. Also, we need to pay, you know, there was a lot of talk of C to N ratios and how to handle C to N ratios. We've known that heavy C, you know, large C, cover crops that have a heavy C-to-N ratio, in other words, an imbalance such as like cereal rye, that those take longer to break down, and in that breaking down of that residual, of the residue, that ties up nitrogen, can tie up other nutrients, and so it can really be devastating to our cash crops. So obviously there was a lot of time that was spent on trying to talk about this. And the first note that I kind of had for that, which I came from Russell Hedricks out in North Carolina, was something that we've always known. It was something that we just were kind of guessing at. And I thought he gave us kind of a good rule of thumb that I wanted to make sure I pass on. So if you have rye or you have a heavy C to N ratio mix a head of corn, and you're trying to raise a grass cash crop like corn, we've known that we need to front load nitrogen to offset that carbon penalty. We've talked about it on the podcast. We've talked, you know, there's a lot of buzz. This is not a secret, but the question is how much and when, right? So the rule of thumb in his opinion is if you think you're going to have nitrogen tied up ahead of corn, or you're even going to be close where you don't want to risk, just front loading all your nitrogen. If you think you're going to be tied up before corn, use 10 pounds of N per leaf stage before you side dress. So if you're going to side dress from that V4, V5 stage, and we think we're going to have we have enough top growth where we're going to be tied up nitrogen, then we would want to put on 10 pounds. You know, so at V4, we'd be at 40 pounds. At V5, we'd put on 50 pounds. And so I thought that was a good rule of thumb. I think that's something to pay attention to. The one thing I did learn, that I did not necessarily know this, and I think it kind of plays on the first few things that I talked about here, was that low C-to-N crops, low C-to-N ratio cover crops, can be devastating to our soil structure as we lack that carbon pump, and we will cause that biology to cannibalize. So because we can break it down so much faster, if we have low C-to-N ratios consistently put on top of each other, so, you know, I know they raise a lot of beans on beans in the South, and, you know, if you're using beans and then you're going to a maybe a diverse, just straight legumes rotation with a cover crop, you know, with straight legumes and then maybe back to beans and so forth and so on, your biology, you know, if we get into a situation where we're winter killing, or that this continual low C to N ratio will actually destruct our soil organic matter and some of our porosity. And that's why we see straight bean-to-bean rotations tend to get really compacted. They tend to get really hard at the surface level. And so that kind of explains some of what was going on. A lot of what I just talked about with the C-to-N and crops, that came from Adam Chappell, farmer from Arkansas. Very terrific, I think an up-and-coming guy. Someone that you should try to pay attention to. There's a lot of really, really practical, good ideas coming from him. So I really liked him. If you get a chance to see him somewhere where he's speaking, you should check him out. There was lots of discussion, you know, and I know the boys, Michael and Mitch kind of touched on these next few things, is there was lots of discussion on integrating livestock as a necessity for the regeneration, right? Because we're trying to mimic nature, we're trying to mimic, you know, whether it be the buffalo herds or just getting animals back onto that square inch of soil. And so it's necessary. It's something that also is a huge profit center for us, and I think I'll probably talk about that in my next episode. But, you know, minimizing soil disturbance, pumping the system with carbon, getting livestock integrated, keeping that living root at all times, that can lead to significant organic matter changes in as little as 2 to 3 years. And so when we're looking at trying to elevate organic matter levels in our soil, we're trying to build those soils up. Those principles, again, minimizing soil disturbance, pumping the system with carbon, keeping a living root at all times, keeping armor on the soil, integration of livestock, those are how you get it done. And that's how you get it done on a pace that rivals, you know, that's faster than any other way that we can do it. So another note, transpiration and evaporation are often grouped together. These need to not be the same. The transpiration buys you something. Evaporation always costs you something. That came from Jay Fuhrer. And that's a very, you know, it's a very important sentence to understand. You're either buying something or you're costing yourself something. And understanding how to control that is going to be paramount to being profitable. Living cover crop will actually increase soil moisture because it draws water from the atmosphere. So one of the main reasons I went down there was to kind of do a lot of research on relay cropping and whether we could add relay cropping into our rotations in our geography to try to increase profitability. And so a living cover crop, one of the biggest objections I get with even talking about relay cropping is that people get so worried about whether you're actually going to rob your relay crop, whether that be soybeans after rye or soybeans after wheat, whether you're going to rob those soybeans of moisture. And it's actually not true. I think that there are points where you have water utilization in that that first crop that you're trying to relay with, but the way that it actually draws moisture from the air, that comes from Ward Labs' research and was something that was said to us by Jimmy Emmons out of, I believe he's out of Missouri, or maybe just, you know, kind of Kansas City area. Could be either on the Kansas side or the Missouri side, not quite sure. But anyways, Jimmy Emmons, I had an opportunity to listen to him, and this was something that he said. And then when I talked to him after the session, said that Ward Labs was the one that had the research on this. So it's not a significant increase that you'll increase with your soil moisture, but I think the key is that we're not going to deplete that ground moisture to the point where we should be concerned about it. So those were a few of the things. Jimmy Evans also said change happens when the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change. And I think that was a common theme that kind of ran through a lot of the presentations, especially the farmer presenters, because most of these guys made the switch to this system because they knew that they were on a timeline. They knew that if they kept doing things the same way, then they would probably not be farming today. That was something that was said multiple times. And so I really appreciated that quote. If you were doing PFLA testing, there was some discussion on PFLA tests. Saprophytic fungi are responsible for breaking down residue, and you can get that level of saprophytic fungi from your PFLA test. And if you look at those numbers, that should somewhat give you an idea of how fast you can break residue down. So as you build that fungus, that fungi in your soil, you should be able to, you'll start seeing that you can break stuff down faster. So if you have a low number, again, going back to a head of corn with 10 pounds of nitrogen per day before you, or leaf stage before you side dress, you know, that would be a good test to take to get an idea. Maybe if you should adjust that number, maybe a little bit higher, maybe you could get away with a little bit lower as you start building biology in your soil. So saprophytic fungi, that's the number I thought was pretty interesting to stay, kind of pay attention to. There was a comment that was made about the BRICS test, and I know that Mitchell and them elaborated on this a little bit, but you know, the key that bugs or pests or insects can't digest complex sugars. And if they do, they actually end up bloating. And because of that bloat, they tend to go find, you know, another feeding source. And so Russell Hedricks talked a little bit about what he's doing based on that research. And that research comes from Jonathan Lundgren, entomologist, I believe at North Dakota University or North Dakota State, but really kind of the key guy with entomology in the regen ag world. And so Russell had a slide where he kind of showed, okay, well, you know what, we've been using sugars. A lot of people have been integrating sugars into their systems, whether that be through dextrose or whether that be through, you know, molasses. And so he did a test where he kind of had all those different types of sugar sources. And then he also used just common table sugar. And this common table sugar actually was the most effective form of sugar in raising that BRICS above 14.5. And 14.5 is kind of the magic number. Once you get your plants to be registering above 14.5 on the BRICS schedule, then they must be full of complex sugars, which cause this natural pest repellent or insect repellent, and you can limit the use of insecticides. To give you an idea of cost, obviously you could go to Costco and buy pallets of, you know, table sugar. You probably could find a wholesale, depending on your scale, you could probably find a wholesale outlet. And it doesn't need to be table quality, right? There's probably different qualities. You need to use 0.5 to 1.5 pounds of sugar. I think Russell's using 0.5 pounds of sugar per 10 gallons of water in furrow. You can also foliar apply over the top at a later time. So the key is to monitor that use rate of sugar with that Brix test and to get you to a certain point that you want to be at. Could play really well with corn borers, possibly. Corn borer flights and non-GMO corn or organic corn. And so wanted to definitely pass that on. If you have standing water in your field, you have an infiltration problem, not a rainfall problem. That's kind of a, you know, that's probably not a surprise to anybody, but there was a lot of talk, you know, about infiltration, about runoff, about water quality. And so that's a good gauge, you know, just good kind of keep that in mind. Then there was just kind of a common trend among a lot of these farmer presenters, you know, of most of them work in family operations, and, you know, they're, you know, everybody kind of made tongue-in-cheek jokes about how, you know, their dad is always their biggest critic. And, you know, so of course, you know, us being a family business, I kind of always find humor in that. I'm sure many of you out there are farming with your family. And so, you know, sometimes it's important to remember that, you know, some of the hardest people to convince, some of the hardest people to, you know, share in your ideas, share in a change, it, you know, can be family. And so, you know, you just got to keep at it. You got to keep on it and stick to what you believe in. So the last thing I want to comment on is we've talked multiple times about a Regen Ag label, right? And we primarily have talked about that in context of the Regen Ag label being a way in which people could direct market their goods and capture a premium for that, right? So, you know, at a very minor scale, if you think of, you know, producing, you know, tomatoes or sweet corn or watermelon, whatever it may be, to go, you know, put in the back of your truck and sell it to a consumer in an urban area to capture retail premium. There are consumers in that area that love the idea of knowing where they get their food and knowing how it's produced. And so, you know, creating awareness in consumers around the regen principles and building soil health and doing all of that from an environmental perspective and should have a good payoff for our growers. And so, you know, you look at that and you say, well, that's great, you know, on a limited scale, right? You know, if I got a garden in my backyard, whatever it may be, that's really great. But what happens when we start to scale this? We're going to need major companies like, you know, General Mills on board with this labeling. You're going to have to. You're going to have, you know, the FDA. You're going to have the EPA. There's going to have to be, you know, all of these regulations to be able to really get this label off ground. And the Soil Health Academy, soil health consultants, I should call them, you know, have been working with General Mills in trying to promote this and create awareness and so forth. And they, so that, you know, General Mills had a session down there. They had two sessions down there, actually, including Thursday's AIM symposium, but where they were talking about this. And we had some mixed reviews. Obviously, I posted some stuff on Facebook. It got and just a comment that we had pretty good chain of conversation on. But here's my takeaway from it. I sat through. I tried to be open-minded. This is something that I want, right? This is something that I hope that everybody can share in to create a positive experience. And I was really disappointed. I'm not going to lie. It was very disappointing hearing GM's approach to this and what they were trying to do. And so they kind of broke us out into small groups, and I was sitting on the edge where I had the opportunity kind of to listen to, you know, multiple groups at once to try to get a holistic picture. And the first thing I would say is that, you know, really General Mills has no idea what they're trying to do. So the first thing they were trying to do was basically get us to help them create their standards, give them input on how to basically sell this to the American farmer. And of course, we're offering that for free. And that's not where I have a problem. What I did have a problem was when they started unraveling their vision. So the question was posed by a guy that was sitting there, and, you know, how are we going to create a sustainable premium, or what type of premium would you guys expect if we can get this off the ground? And, you know, the presenter of that circle said for most of the group, or all of the group to hear, that they thought that the cost savings that a person who implements regenerative agriculture practices, their production costs will decrease, right? So if we sell it at the same price level, you're making more margin on that. But I would argue you are making that margin anyways at the bare minimum. So they thought that that savings in the cost of production was enough to offset the advantage of offering a premium. So essentially, if I'm hearing this correctly, they want to give you, they don't want to give you a premium. They want you to just do this and then create more nutrient-dense food for them to process to be able to sell at the retail level. So, and I should back up with a statement that more nutrient-dense food for them means that they need less to produce the same output. They need less to produce the same output. Now, they have a strong desire from a business sense to get as much of the more nutrient-dense food that they can, as it requires less of it to produce the same amount. That's a natural increase in the margins that they make. And then they turn around and say to you as the farmer, we are not going to provide you with anything to incentivize you to do that. You should just do that out of your own free will, knowing that your cost of production is lower. I think that that's the wrong approach, right? I don't agree with that. If you feel different, feel free to reach out. I'd love to hear your comments. Second thing that really struck me wrong was in the discussion of, I'm losing my train of thought here a minute. The go-to-market strategy and what their long-term vision was. Well, they come out and they said, our long-term vision, what we feel would be ideal, that's the word that was used, ideal, would be that we would basically tie up your whole rotation over a long period of time. So they want a contract with the grower over, let's just, a long period of time. It's pretty subjective, but let's just use this in a 10-year time frame, right? So we're going to buy your, you know, three crop rotation, which is a part of that standard. You have to have three cash crops, one of them being a cereal. Of course, it's General Mills. That's what they do. They make, you know, cereals. They make everything out of a cereal grain. And they want to buy all of that production. They want to limit your market access, right? They're going to tell you what they're going to buy it for, dictated by the market. They're going to offer you no premium. And they want to make sure that they're the sole purchaser of that. If that's not controlling your income, if that's not borderline indentured servitude, I don't know what is. Again, this is a company that has basically just said, you guys are creating a system that is bettering our planet, reducing your cost of production, and going to benefit us from a margins perspective, and we want to share in none of you. We want to share with you none of the gains from a financial standpoint, but we want all of what you can produce. So I want you to think about this from a holistic approach, right? And I want to give you a little background on General Mills. So General Mills, there's a brand called Annie's. Annie's oatmeal, and, you know, maybe they do some other stuff. I'm not super familiar with it, but I do remember when they broke on this Annie's brand line and how they had purchased, and Mitchell, I'm sure, is going to call me out on this because I can never remember the specifics, but it was over 30,000 acres in North Dakota, purchased this big ranch to be able to control from start to finish the production for for this Annie's Oatmeal. And they hired some outsourcing groups. We don't need to go into all that. But they basically hired people to manage this land that they own to produce this crop in a more efficient, more margin territory where they control it from start to finish, right? We just seen this with nitrogen with the Koch brothers, right? Like start to finish nitrogen, they control nitrogen from start to finish, and what's happening with the price of fertilizer right now in the ag world. Not a good thing for the American farmer. We are selling for less at the market, and our cost of inputs continue to increase. Okay, so now, let's just keep that background in mind. This has been a disaster. So is it too far for me to extrapolate the General Mills in their boardroom and wherever big city they're at, sit around and say, look, we took a stance at trying to control things from start to finish, but we don't want the liability that comes with landowning and production and so forth. So then, you know, the regen movement gives them a lot of marketing upside to be able to be looked at as a sustainably, global environment protector. You know, there's a lot of marketable upside to partnering with the regen movement. But the big upside lies in the fact of nutrient density, right? And as we learn more about how our soils provide nutrient density and, the betterment of our soils increases a nutrient-dense crop where they can produce more with less, right? Why would they not be on board? So I heard some comments like, well, at least they're there. At least they're acknowledging the regen movement. Of course they are. Why wouldn't they be? This is a big upside profit potential for them. If the science is real, right, which I believe it is, if the science is real, this is big time upside potential for them to control the supply chain. The 100% give you no premium, right? Basically, tie up all your production, control the pricing, buy it at market price. Who's going to benefit from that? How is that going to make the American farmer more money? I don't understand that. I can't get on board with it. It's exactly what we would expect. Shame on us for expecting more, maybe, is the best way to put it. It's just really distasteful. I was really, really distasteful of that. The other thing to remember here is if they can produce more with less, if the nutrient density increases nationwide, the demand goes down. Demand goes down, and if we talk to a wheat grower, wheat prices are not good. Now all of a sudden you throw more wheat into the supply chain with demand decreasing, that's a net positive increase. How is that going to lead to a higher commodity price for you without a premium? How is that going to cash flow when we can't cash flow right now? I shouldn't say we. Some of us, right? How is that going to cash flow? So it's distasteful. I'm not happy about it. Feel free to, you don't always have to send me stuff when you disagree with me. If you support it, I'd love to hear some feedback. Make me feel better. So, anyways. You got any comments? You want to hear more? I know I covered a real large breadth of things right there, but when you go to one of these things, you just hear so much. It's hard to sometimes it's hard to narrow it down. So hit me up at Seed Junkie on Twitter, at Stout Seed on Facebook, and look forward to hearing your responses.